This is Free Speech Radio News for Tuesday, October 10, 2006. From KPFK in Los Angeles, I'm Aura Bogado. The fallout from North Korea's nuclear tests continues and leads to division in the UN Security Council. On World Day Against the Death Penalty, we'll hear how Nigeria is commuting death sentences to life imprisonment. And shifting options put Republicans on thin ice just 4 weeks before voters head to the polls. We'll bring you those stories and more after the headlines.
I'm Shannon Young with the Free Speech Radio News headlines. British airport authorities temporarily closed down one of the terminals at London's Heathrow Airport today due to security concerns sparked by a piece of luggage abandoned at a check-in area. Reuters reports that one man has been arrested under Britain's Terrorism Act. In Taiwan, massive mobilizations continue to demand the resignation of President Chen Shui-bian, who has been widely accused of corruption along with members of his family. Hundreds of thousands of protesters hit the streets in Taipei today, dressed in red and giving the symbolic thumbs down as the president commemorated Taiwan National Day. Taiwanese legislators are to vote on a recall bill later this week. India has extended its ban on child labor to include the domestic work, hospitality, and food service sectors. Bino Alex reports.
India's official ban on child labor in households, restaurants, hotels, and resorts came into effect from today. But the government has not developed any alternative programs for the millions of children who work in roadside food stalls or as domestic servants. On the eve of the ban, which applies to children under 14, Prime Minister Manmohan Singh warned of firm action against violators, but appealed to give up the practice voluntarily. A five-decade-old ban on children working in industries deemed hazardous, such as fireworks, matchstick-making, gas stations, or carpet weaving, has not been effective. On the contrary, these industries became hubs for child labor. The Labor Ministry says there are 12 million such children. Analysts wonder how the new ban will hold up in a country where so many impoverished children must work in order to survive. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Pino Alex.
The United Nations Security Council yesterday approved the nomination of Ban Ki-moon to succeed Kofi Annan as the Secretary General of the World Body. A career diplomat, Ban Ki-moon currently acts as the Foreign Minister of South Korea. The General Assembly is expected to approve the nomination. Kofi Annan's term ends on January 1st. Peru's President Alan Garcia met with President George W. Bush today to discuss matters of trade and coca eradication. Pamela Cueva reports from Lima.
After the 1.5-hour meeting today at the White House, the two presidents say they are looking forward to U.S. congressional approval of the free trade agreement between United States and Peru. Another topic of discussion was the extension of a coca eradication agreement. Peru's government has already approved a bilateral trade agreement, but the U.S. Congress won't take up the issue until after the November elections. In Peru, many groups disagree with the approval of this free trade agreement. This approval runs particularly high among farmers and within indigenous communities. During his trip to Washington, D.C., President Garcia will meet with the managing director of the International Monetary Fund, the president of the World Bank, and with the head of the Inter-American Development Bank. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Pamela Cueva with Alfredo Cuadros from Lima, Peru.
Two former Western governors have gone on record saying that time is of the essence in deciding whether to remove four dams in southern Washington state, affecting Northwest salmon runs. Mary Catherine Roundtree has more.
Bruce Babbitt, who was Clinton's interior secretary, joined former Oregon Governor John Kitzhaber in saying the federal government should cut its losses and seriously look at removing the four dams in southeastern Washington state as the way to revive the Northwest's endangered and threatened salmon runs. Babbitt says $8 billion spent on various salmon recovery ideas over the past 20 years have not worked.
Well, I think we are up against a decision either to say we're going to write off the salmon and let them go extinct, or we're going to entertain a serious discussion about solving the real problem, which is the four dams on the Snake River.
Babbitt says it's up to the taxpaying public to force the issue. Courtroom battles over salmon recovery are coming to a head. A frustrated federal judge, James Redden, in Portland, recently admonished the Bush administration to finally submit an adequate salmon plan. Redden wrote that the federal agencies, quote, have repeatedly and collectively failed to demonstrate a willingness to do what is necessary. Mary Catherine Roundtree, Free Speech Radio News, Moscow, Idaho.
The West African nation of Liberia opened investigations into abuses committed during the country's 24-year-long civil war. The task of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, established by President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, is to gather evidence of past crimes. It does not have the authority to prosecute offenders. The most high-profile figure from the era of Liberia's civil conflict is rebel leader and former president Charles Taylor, who faces war crimes charges at the International Criminal Court in The Hague. And those are the headlines. I'm Shannon Young for Free Speech Radio News.
Whether to punish North Korea for testing a nuclear device may cause division amongst permanent members of the United Nations Security Council permanent seats. Russia and China are shying away from punishment, while the United States pushes for sanctions against Kim Jong-il's nation. FSRN's Selena Masuta has more from Washington, D.C.
Despite wide condemnation of North Korea, even outright criticism coming from North Korea's ally, China, the question of how to address the country's dismissal of criticism over their nuclear program varies within the UN Security Council. The United States is pushing for sanctions, including provisions that prohibit all trade in military and luxury goods to the country. Despite the division, U.S. Ambassador to the UN John Bolton says that an agreement between the permanent five can be met.
I think we've got some general guidance back that the Chinese gave to us. Our experts are meeting now. Very frequently in these sorts of discussions, when you actually put the language on the page, differences turn out to be more resolvable than they might otherwise appear. On the other hand, sometimes differences become more intractable. So I think it's really in the drafting process that many of these issues will be worked out.
The U.S. hopes that the real threat of sanctions may force North Korea to go back to six-party talks. However, the U.S. has dismissed suggestions of direct talks between the United States and the Pyongyang government. Meanwhile, North Korea's ambassador to the UN, Park Gil-jeon, says that the UN is blowing the nuclear test out of proportion.
It will be better for the Security Council of the United Nations to congratulate the DPRK scientists and researchers instead of doing such a notorious, useless, and reckless resolutions or whatever the statement against the DPRK.
The U.S.'s refusal to enter into direct talks with North Korea has escalated the conflict, says critics like John Pfeffer. Pfeffer is the co-director of the Foreign Policy in Focus and author of several books on Korea.
North Korea is a difficult country to negotiate with. They're tough. However, they have on any number of occasions said that they want bilateral discussions with the United States, because they feel that the United States really holds the key, that if the United States decides for whatever reasons that it's time to have a diplomatic solution, that they will establish the precedent and everyone else will follow along.
Ambassador Bolton is also pushing for the UN Security Council to support a Chapter 7 resolution that includes the threat of military action. Selena Masuda, FSRN, in Washington, D.C.
Voters will head to the polls 4 weeks from today to elect a new Congress, a portion of the Senate, and many local seats, and a significant shift has already swung public opinion. Polls that had Democrats and Republicans tied 4 weeks ago are now showing Democrats with a major lead. FSRN's Leanne Caldwell takes a look at the Virginia Senate race that illustrates this trend. A Republican incumbent who seemed miles ahead is now in a dead heat. Last night, Republican incumbent Senator George Allen and Democratic candidate Jim Webb squared off in their last debate.
The race for Virginia Senate was not expected to be close, but it's been a difficult journey for Republican incumbent Senator George Allen. Democratic candidate Jim Webb has been making gains ever since Senator Allen used a racial slur, macaca. The derogatory French word to describe people of color has been shown around the country on internet sites, news programs, and Comedy Central over and over again. And college classmates accused Senator Allen of using the N-word in college, and the Associated Press reported yesterday that Senator Allen withheld $1.1 million worth of stock options in his required financial disclosures. Last night, Senator Allen and Jim Webb had their last chance to defend themselves and attack each other in a face-to-face public forum. The debate started with questions regarding their personal beliefs. Senator Allen denied using the N-word and defended himself against accusations.
What I said is I don't recall using that word, But the stories were portraying it as if that word were part of my vocabulary, which it was not.
Jim Webb, former Secretary of the Navy and official in the Reagan administration, is running as a Democrat. He defended an article he wrote in 1979 that said women aren't trustworthy in combat.
So the question, I'm very comfortable with where the United States military is today. I've said it many times. That article was about women in specific combat military occupational specialties.
The debate also addressed the war in Iraq. One main reason Webb is running for office. He's expressed opposition to this war since the beginning and supports a timely troop withdrawal.
We need to get an announcement from this government that we have no desire for long-term bases in Iraq and that we need to reach overtly for a diplomatic solution. And we need to bring the countries in the region to the table.
George Allen calls that a cut-and-run strategy.
Rather than retreating, we need to make sure that Iraq is not a safe haven for terrorist organizations because it's too risky for our security.
Taxes was also a hot issue. Senator Allen touted the tax cuts passed last year and tried to tie his opponent to the big spending so-called Senate liberals, John Kerry and Hillary Clinton. Jim Webb responded by saying corporate loopholes should be closed to increase revenue and the war in Iraq should wind down, which would also free up cash.
You can't keep spending like this without increasing revenues.
Both candidates said China is a major threat to the United States, a position Jim Webb has held for years. He says their nuclear capability, expanding army and growing economy, threatens national security. Jim Webb said he's opposed to a referendum on the Virginia ballot to amend the state constitution to ban same-sex marriage, not because he believes same-sex couples should marry, but because of the legal repercussions that could result. And Webb refused to answer a question on if detainees held at Guantanamo Bay Detention Center should have access to habeas corpus or the ability to challenge their detention, a measure denying detainees that right passed Congress 2 weeks ago. And Jim Webb opposes affirmative action as it is today.
The program grew like Topsy, so that every ethnic minority was included in affirmative action to the point that the people who were excluded basically were the white males.
The latest poll on this race shows Senator Allen and Jim Webb tied. The Gallup poll was released Friday and reveals 48% for Allen and 45% for Webb, with 5% undecided. A Mason-Dixon poll also released last week showed the two tied at 43%. These are the first polls to show such close public opinion since the race began. But groups in Virginia who support minority rights and low-income issues aren't yet convinced that Jim Webb is the right candidate. They do know that George Allen does not support their issues. King Salim Kalfani is executive director of the Virginia chapter of the NAACP.
It's interesting that both of them praise Reagan. Webb, you know, was a Reagan follower. Mr. Allen, similarly, and votes with Mr. Bush. So really, there's not a clear choice to us. But we know that one has a voting record that's been anathema to the NAACP.
The Virginia NAACP disapproves of Allen's voting record as senator and Virginia governor. They are unsure about Webb because of affirmative action, women's issues, housing, and employment. They have meetings scheduled with him to address some of their concerns. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
More than 1,000 mourners paid their respects to slain Russian journalist Anna Politkovskaya, who was buried in Moscow today. A hard-hitting investigative journalist critical of the Kremlin's policies in Chechnya, Politkovskaya was gunned down on Saturday in her apartment complex in what many believe was a contract killing. At least a dozen reporters have been killed in Russia in the past 6 years. Russian President Vladimir Putin, who was heavily criticized for not publicly recognizing her murder earlier, called her death disgustingly cruel, but also discounted Politkovskaya's work, saying she only had a minor influence on Russian politics. No high-ranking Kremlin official attended Politkovskaya's funeral. The Inter-American Press Association held their annual assembly in Mexico City last week. One topic of discussion was violence against Mexican journalists, particularly in the northern border region, considered one of the most dangerous places to practice journalism. More than 20 reporters have been assassinated and 3 have been kidnapped in the last 6 years. FSRN's Alonso Rivera reports from Tijuana.
On April 2005, Alfredo Jimenez, a reporter from the Mexican northern state of Sonora, disappeared days after he published an investigation on organized crime in the region. More than a year has passed, and still no sign of Alfredo. Last week, his family received a special award for his courageous work from the Inter-American Press Association during their 62nd assembly. Diana Daniels, president of the association, said during the opening ceremony that we must not allow crimes against fellow journalists to go unpunished. Governments and public opinion should raise their voices to demand that those who have killed journalists be brought to justice. According to Carlos Lauria, America's program director of the Committee to Protect Journalists, Mexico, particularly the northern border states, have become one of the most dangerous areas for journalists to do their work in Latin America.
Basically, what's going on is, as the war against drug cartels intensified, journalists who report on drug trafficking and organized crime are facing grave dangers, and this has caused, at the same time, violent attacks against journalists who engage in this kind of reporting, and at the same time, there's widespread censorship.
Lauria and the Committee to Protect Journalists have been doing a lot of research work in Mexico. They have traveled to several border towns, including Nuevo Laredo, where gunmen stormed the offices of the daily newspaper El Mañana with bullets and hand grenades. They also traveled to Tijuana a few months after the killing of Francisco Ortiz Franco in 2004. The editor of the weekly newspaper Zeta, famous for its in-depth reporting on organized crime. Ortiz Franco was shot point-blank by two hitmen in front of his two kids. Marco Castro is a young reporter from Zeta. He has been covering the organized crime beat for a year now and is beginning to understand what fellow journalists have gone through and how their lives are endangered when they start publishing details of the organized crime activities.
When you don't stop publishing, there are two options. They pressure you to quit, or they kill you.
Castro was told recently that a fellow journalist was followed by a suspicious vehicle, which led to a high-speed chase.
He told me he was in shock. He had his camera, but it's not a gun, so his only defense was his car.
Fortunately, he got away. But more than 21 journalists have been murdered and three have disappeared in the last 6 years in Mexico. Violence has made newspaper reporters cut down on their investigating of organized crime activities and in some cases stop publishing the reporter's name in order to ensure their safety. For Victor Clark, a longtime human rights advocate and investigator based in Tijuana, this is a direct attack to their human rights.
Of course, this is an attack to their freedom of expression, to their right to live, and it cuts down on their freedom. Some censor themselves and don't talk about it, but some do it very courageously.
This might seem like a misfortune, but for Marco Castro, another Mexican journalist covering the organized crime, not having his byline published or even cutting down on their investigating is just a way to survive. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Alonso Rivera in Tijuana.
Police in Baghdad have found the bullet-ridden, tortured bodies of 60 men in the past 24 hours, apparently the victims of ever-increasing sectarian violence. A car bomb exploded near a Sunni mosque today, killing 10 people and injuring four. A separate car bomb yesterday in a Shiite district Monday claimed 13 lives and left 46 people injured. As the violence continues under U.S. occupation, Iraq's everyday carnage is making life for families in the country increasingly unbearable. With more on what Iraqi mothers and grandmothers face in their lives, FSRN's Salam Talib and Eliana Kaya bring us this report.
Family structure is one of the most important elements in Iraqi society. Among the many untold costs of war is how Iraqi's ongoing and unstable security situation has caused major change in family life. Saad is a 55-year-old mother of 8 children. She had encouraged her family to leave Baghdad, the city where they have lived for the last 30 years. She wants them to move to the south of Iraq and seeking safer living conditions for the family.
I tried to convince my family to move away from Baghdad, but they do not listen to me. My husband said that we will die anywhere we go. The whole country is dangerous, so he prefers to die in his own city. He said that we can't find jobs in other cities, and we don't have money to rent a house somewhere else. Yesterday, a fighter raided one of our Shia's neighbor's house. They killed the father along with his son.
Other families have already experienced similar tragedies themselves. 70-year-old Om Jabbar told FSRN about one of her grandchildren who was injured 3 days ago. She expressed concern about the future of her family.
Now I'm staying at the hospital with my grandchild and his mother. His name is Sarmed. He is 10 years old. His mother tried to keep him home, but he wants to play with his friends outside the house. A mortar injured him. His leg was almost amputated. His friend was hit by shrapnel in his spine.
Om Jabbar lives in the neighborhood of Al-Hurriya in Baghdad, where sectarian violence broke out 2 weeks ago.
We can't walk in the streets even two blocks away from the house. It is not just us, it is everybody in the neighborhood trapped in their houses. I shop for 10 minutes a day just for food and head back home as fast as I can.
But it's not only sectarian violence that Iraqi families have to endure. The price of food is rising due to escalation in violence. Om Haider is 38 years old and a mother of five children.
The food is so expensive. I work in the family's palm date farm. We sold 400 pounds of dates for just $100, while one chicken cost $15. It used to cost $1. Vegetables cost $6. They used to cost 50 cents, and Coca-Cola cost $2. We did not need it before. I told the kids that if they eat just the vegetables today, then we could buy a cell phone for each of them. It costs just $5 to buy a cell phone.
Traffic jams caused by the roadblocks and military troops are also adding a heavy load for Iraqi lives.
We are not just suffering from violence everywhere, but also from the American military. When the American military drives down the street, all the cars have to stop or have to drive on unpaved roads just to avoid them. Today we waited about 2 hours for the military to pass so we could use the road. We were afraid of them. They have no mercy. When my daughters leave home to go to school, I expect that I may never see them again. Kidnapping, killing, car bombs, and the American military. It is too much to survive.
For Free Speech Radio News, I am Salam Talib with Ilyana Kaya.
As a coalition of groups around the world observe World Day Against the Death Penalty today, Nigeria has taken a significant step towards abolishing capital punishment. About 600 people in various jails across the country are awaiting execution, but their sentences are being commuted to life imprisonment. FSRN's Samuel Okoya reports from Lagos.
The Nigerian government says the names of all those sentenced to death by federal high courts is being compiled to enable it publish an official gazette commuting their sentences to life imprisonment. The decision to commute all death sentences passed by federal high courts followed a nationwide debate initiated 3 years ago on capital punishment. Chief Akinolu Olujimi, who at the time was Attorney General of the Federation and Minister of Justice, initiated the debate. He said the idea was to know what Nigerians feel about the death penalty in the face of international trend, which has seen many countries abolish capital punishment.
In America today, you have some states that have abolished the death penalty, and you have some states that insist on retaining death penalty in their statute books. In Britain, the death penalty thing, has been abolished. Now, we cannot pretend, not to know or see what is happening in other parts of the world.
Damian Ugu, whose group, the Civil Liberties Organization, has over the years campaigned against capital punishment, welcomes the government decision.
Well, I think it's a good start. For once, the government has come out to show interest in the case of death sentences that are passed on people, in some cases unjustly. And I feel it's a good start for now.
But human rights activists say there is still a long way to go in the effort to totally abolish the death penalty in Nigeria. In northern Nigeria, where Islamic law is in place, all those sentenced to death are not covered by the new policy to abolish the death penalty because the courts are not under the direct control of the Nigerian government. Muslims in the region say they are not prepared to abandon the Islamic law, which allows for the death penalty for offenses like adultery. Umar Abubakar, a Muslim youth from northern Nigeria, says Islamic law has to be followed to the letter because it is an injunction from God.
The appropriate punishment for adultery is stoning to death. If laws are not applied according to God's injunctions, crime rate will rise. If we do things the way God asked us to do them, society will be better. But if things are not done according to God's wish, there can never be peace. Society has to live according to God's injunctions.
The introduction of Islamic law in Nigeria 6 years ago caused national controversy. It is believed the controversy will only deepen if Muslims insist on retaining the death penalty, despite the Nigerian government's plans to totally abolish it. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Sam Olukoya in Lagos.
And now, from his cell on Pennsylvania's death row, a commentary from Mumia Abu-Jamal.
What can we say on the 40th anniversary of the founding of the Black Panther Party? Many of us are justly proud of our service in the movement, and many of us, even though the party has been defunct for decades, remain active in social movements, working in our communities, trying to make life better in the face of the long white war against black freedom and liberation. Yet, I know, if we're honest, that many of you felt the tremendous void when Hurricane Katrina ravaged our people and the political elites added grievous insult to injury by attacking poor blacks for not drowning quietly. I felt longing for the party, for a political entity strong enough, committed enough to defend our people in times of need. I longed for a party that could organize that vast and deep black angst and rage, not for an election, not for a politician, but for independent action in our own interests. That said, it was refreshing to see Malik Rahim, a former party member, take the lead in speaking out on behalf of the people of New Orleans, organizing support and, yes, survival programs, remember that, for those most in need. His training was not in vain. 40 years ago, social conditions gave rise to the party. Today, we face equally grim, if not worse, social conditions. For unemployment, police terror, injustices in the courts, a damnable educational system, these things still plague our people's lives. Yet a program without a party is like a screw without a screwdriver. It can't work. I'm here to report to you the independent initiation of the New African Black Panther Party, which, unlike similar such formations, has young members who truly study the lives and writings of Dr. Huey P. Newton, Eldridge Cleaver, George Jackson, and other OPs, you know, original Panthers, who made contributions to our people's struggle. They call their ideology Pantherism. I think the OPs would be proud. In other words, the struggle continues. From Death Row, this is your brother, Mumia Abu-Jamal.
These commentaries are produced by Prison Radio.
You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. From KPFK in Los Angeles, I'm Ada Bogado.